Well, welcome to QSO Live. Ted here with very little voice left, and my co-host David is with us tonight.
And a good evening to you, sir.
I don't know why I chose Nutrocker. You know, that's
a good song.
It would wake you up if you're asleep, I think, you know, and I don't know how many folks are out there sleeping, but anyways, Bee Bumble and the Stingers and Nutrocker. This is WTWW. This is QSO Live. We've got a very special guest with us tonight, and I think you folks are really going to enjoy this fellow because he's just very versed in so many different things. And I can't think, every time we get together and talk, we always have a lot of fun. I'd like to say good evening and hello to Kirk Harnack. And
hello. Hello.
He is KD5FYD.
That's right.
I don't know if it's, have you ever come up with some phonetics for that? I mean, do you have anything that's...
Nothing meaningful, just stuff that was really dumb. Maybe our listeners could help me out with that.
Yeah, you know, y'all need to come up with something and then write us and tell us for Kirk. His call sign, KD5FYD.
Kilo Delta 5, then Foxtrot Yankee Delta. Kilo Delta 5, Foxtrot Yankee Delta.
And come up with a real good, really good phonetic. A friend of mine, Bob Mason, always used to use, he was WB8CAC, and he used Whiskey Bravo 8 Constipated Albanian Cucumbers.
Oh jeez!
Yeah, you know, with my call WB8PUM, a fellow by the name of Kenny Kiefer out of one of the Virginias, he used to talk to him every night, and he said that WB8PUM. He said WB8 spelled wobulate, and PUM was Papa under Mama. So you get some reaction when you use those phonetics. I will have to say, depending on the person you're talking to, you know. But you know, that's the whole thing. The whole thing is it's all about having fun. And one of the things I like to do, and I like this on 2 meters locally, because one of our big complaints is there's not enough activity on 2 meters, and we've got too many Gestapos up there running people off, you know. But we need more people. We need massive amounts of people on 2 meters. But I would get on, and you got 10 minutes before you have to legally ID. So you can get into a pretty good conversation, you know. So you get into the conversation, and you're 5-6 minutes in, and then you say, oh, by the way, I was going to ask you, how hard is it to get a license for one of these radios? And depending on who you're talking to, we'll determine the outcome, you know.
That's well, rich.
One of the things I want to cover here in that, and that is right now, Kirk Harnack is a relatively new amateur radio operator. I say relatively new. I mean, you've been at this now, what? How long? For ham radio.
Well, let's see. I got that license, KD5FYD, as a no code technician. That would have been when I lived in Mississippi, and that would have been in the late 90s. So I've been licensed since probably 98. Yeah.
Well, then how did I get the impression that there had been a major change just recently that you had? Did you upgrade
Yes, I got, I sat for the exam for the general class, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was, actually, this was several years ago, back when my own podcast was over on Leo Laporte's Twit network, twit.tv network. And Leo was in what was then his new studio. He's since moved out of it. And he was getting his ham license. Well, my wife and I were in Petaluma, California, because Leo had graciously invited us to the grand opening party of his new studios. And the company I work for, the Telus Alliance, provided some of the equipment that went into his studios. A little bit of it was promotional, and the rest of it was purchased. And so I was there in Petaluma a couple days in advance of the party. So I'm making friends, and well, it turns out that there's going to be a ham radio event at Leo's new studio, because Leo's going to be sitting for his general license. Well, Leo had a study book for the general license, right? And I'm sorry, it's slipping my mind. What's the name of the guy that writes so many of those books? Used to write them for Radio Shack.
Gordon West, probably.
Yes, yes, it was Gordon West. So I'm there at Leo's studio, And Leo loaned me his book. He said, you know, you can sit for this exam like on a Saturday morning, because all the hams will be here. I'm sure somebody will proctor the exam for you. Well, Gordon West was there. And Gordon's lovely wife, whose name I can't remember right now either, but oh man, she is smart as a tack. Holy cow. So
that's where Gordon gets it all then.
Yes.
The truth comes out here now.
Gordon's the character. His wife is just as smart as a whip. Sharp as a tack, smart as a whip. My wife and Gordon's wife got along famously. They had a lot to talk about. And I chatted with Gordon. Anyway, Gordon was a little bit busy with the festivities, so Gordon's wife was my one of my VEs. I forget how. Seems like there were three people in the room and me. Is that right? You have three VEs in the room?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So nobody cheated. There were three VEs in the room, and Gordon West's wife was one of them. And I sat for the exam, and they gave me the results a little while later, and I passed the general. So using Leo Laporte's study book that was written by Gordon West. It was a great. Oh, and you know who else was there? It was Bob Heil. He wasn't one of the VEs, but he was there for the parties too. So
he and Gordo hang out quite a little bit. They're good buddies, you know. So you have to.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say, what's strange about that story is I had a friend of mine that was taking the Elkins second class. A commercial phone ticket. I don't know. Do you remember when there were these crash courses? The reason why
I remember those. Sure.
And the reason why they were is because there was a lot of AM directionals, and they wanted the disc jockey to be able to take the meter readings. You know, so if he didn't have a second phone, he couldn't do it. So these crash courses came about. Elkins was one of them. You know, when I was younger, and I thought, man, I'd be cool to pay the money and take the test, or, you know, take the class and then take the test, you know. So this friend of mine, he went through that whole thing, and then he called me on the phone, and he said, hey, I'm going down to take the test. And he said, would you want to ride with me on the bus? This was in the Detroit area. So I said, sure. So I rode with him. When we stopped in Dearborn, there was a changeover. You got on one bus. Then when you got into East and West Dearborn, you switched buses, and that bus took you into Detroit. And then you had to finagle your way around downtown to get to the federal building. And anyhow, we stopped in one of the Dearborns, and I stopped at this place called Cuda's Bookstore. Now, any of you folks that are Detroiters, you'll remember this place, because it was that was where you went to find different rare books. I went in, and I bought the Amico Second Class Study Guide, and I read that on the bus on the way in to the FCC. So I went in, and I said, I'm going to go ahead and take it anyways just to see what it's about, you know. And so I took the test, he took the test, I passed, he failed. And he wouldn't talk to me, he wouldn't ride on the same bus with me back home. I mean, it was just, it was pretty bad, you know, it really was really bad. And of course, I didn't mean anything by it, you know, it was just one of those things. But I had been, I had a background in ham radio, so it wasn't as foreign to me as it would be someone who just, like himself, he didn't have any background at all, you know. But those tests were, those licenses were coveted because the disc jockey could take the meter readings, you know, so you could work a four-tower DA or three-tower DA or two-tower DA, whatever, you know. So that was. Now, you know, first off, I was in error. I didn't know that you'd been licensed as long as you had. And but you're getting the general is the event that I'm remembering, because I remember you were all excited and said, I got my ticket. I remember when you told me that. And
yeah,
I thought, well, you know, but I thought that was the first ticket you got, so I, you know, here I am. This is, you know, and I'll tell you, after we're off the air, I'll tell you a little bit what it's like to be stupid, okay? So anyways, anyhow, so.
I already know.
Okay, you've got your general now. Have you done any operating on HF? I mean, this guy runs all over the world. I mean, literally, he's on an airplane, and he's, you know, I'll text him, and I'll say, hey, by the way, do you know how to do this or that? And he'll write me back, and he'll say, well, yeah, I do, but it's a little awkward. I'm in Istanbul, you know, and I'm like, you know, I was like, why? Anyhow, so, but have you had a chance to do any much operating at all, or are you still just really busy, swamped, always running and going?
Well, after I got my general, I did, I wouldn't say I hurried out and purchased, but within a few months, I purchased my first HF-capable radio. And I'd been doing plenty of 2 meter and 440 before then. And I really got to play around a lot with EchoLink or what IRLP. Yeah. And so I had a great time chatting up people in typically Australia. Seems like I always got hold of somebody in Australia because it was late afternoon, early evening here, and it was morning in Australia. So I'd talk to, you know, plumbers going on the way to work on the, you know, on the East Coast, Sydney, Brisbane, you know, that kind of place. So that's what I had done, you know, prior to getting the general ticket. But I went out and with a little Christmas money, I guess, I bought a, I think it was a used one. It's right here in front of me now. I didn't buy it new. It's an ICOM IC7000. Okay.
All right.
And, don't know much of, you know, I mean, I looked through all of it, listened a whole lot, and I bought a, an antenna tuner. Hang on. See what it is here. I bought an LDG Electronics IT100 auto tuner. All right.
Okay, so now you've got the radio, you've got the tuner. So what did you hang in the backyard? Anything, or you were trying to tune up on a tree, or what's the antenna system?
Antenna?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought I just needed the auto tuner. I thought that's what that was for.
That's for the bed springs.
By the way, hi Dave. It's good to talk to you, man.
That's good to talk to you too, sir.
Hey, I bought a G5 RV antenna, just your basic thing up there with a ballon and long wires, and you know, got some bricks. And after I threw them up in the air and hit myself, I finally got a brick through the tree, you know, with a string tied onto it.
You're throwing a brick through a tree.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't. Okay,
we're gonna have to have a talk after this show.
So
you didn't lie in one at the neighbor's house, did you, somewhere?
I live on a big piece of property, so I'm not that strong to hit the neighbor's house.
Well, see, most people use the, you know, the bow and arrow or the slingshot or something, you know, and get them way up there in the tippy top of the trees, you know, and pull the thing up. But now, to start off with, I'm just going to tell you, of course, I'm not politically correct about anything, but, you know,
let me guess. I picked the wrong antenna.
I was going to say, I'm going to say, I agree with old Cactus, and if Cactus is listening, to me and to us, we refer to G5 RVs as dummy loads, okay?
Well,
and they're all right as long as you're not on 80 meters. If you're on 80, they're terrible, but on 40 and up, they do okay. So, but you're probably going to be, you know, 40 and up because you're probably not going to do a lot of nighttime operating, I would imagine.
Well, there's plenty of people who get into a hobby and they have a disappointing first experience and they quit. Yeah. This happens a lot with a lot of hobbies. And so whatever equipment they bought to do this hobby with goes fallow, you know, goes unused. Mm-hmm. And eventually they sell it in a yard sale years later and their dream of pursuing their hobby, you know, didn't come true. Well, I could have let that happen to me because from my experience, the G5, and I got the ends of it way up in two trees. I mean, it was almost horizontal. The middle of it was attached to my chimney, and I have a two-story house on the side of a hill, and the slope of the hill that I'm on faces east-northeast, okay? And I've got the top of the chimney has got plenty of height above the ground, and I put it on a small pole above that. So it was actually the ballon and the, you know, the feed point of the G5 RV was just above the chimney height, about 3 feet. And the ends of the antenna were not really sloping down. They were almost horizontal into trees at either end of the house, actually away from the house. So I had plenty of distance on the horizontals. In fact, I think both of them were horizontal. I had a you know, some string tied to the end. Not string's the wrong word. It was almost a rope, a small rope. So they were pulled out right. And then I had, you know, the ladder line from the G5 RV came down about halfway down the side of the house, at which point, you know, it had UHF connector on it, you know, the SO239 connector.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So go ahead.
and so I got to make sure I do. And then the unbalanced coax, probably 60 feet of it to come on into the house and into the auto tuner. Well, I, for a few weeks, I just played listening, right? And I could pick up some really strong stuff, but I never felt like I was picking up a lot of stuff on any band. So one day I'm talking to this guy. I think you know him. He's a broadcast engineer in Milwaukee, Chris Tarr. Right?
I don't think I know Chris, but go ahead. Let's hear this story now. It's getting thicker here.
So I'm talking to Chris and I'm expressing my disappointment with what I'm receiving, but I've not transmitted yet with this thing. Well, I mean, I transmitted long enough to see if the auto tuner seemed like it was doing its job, but yeah. And the, you know, Vizwar was good and low and all that. So Chris said, well, why don't we just have a QSO? So he was the expert. I'm the novice, although licensed as a general, I'm really a novice. And he picked out a frequency, 7 something megahertz. And so we agreed on the frequency and we're both on the phone and we're trying to talk to each other on our radios while we're on the phone. And I want to say this was late in the afternoon one day. And maybe I heard him, maybe not, I don't know. And he thinks maybe he heard me. And that's really the only on HF. That's the only QSO I've attempted. And right after that, we had to have our roof redone, so I had to pull the antenna in and get it out of the way for the roofers. And so now I'm ready to put up the right antenna and try this again.
Well, I on wire antennas, okay. I will only run one system, and that's because I'm old. And I've tried everything under the sun, and I landed on this combination. I use a dipole, just a straight dipole. I use open wire line from the dipole into the shack, and I use a Johnson kilowatt matchbox, which is a link-coupled antenna tuner. And it's like the combination is just like something magic, okay? Yeah, and you can find the matchboxes around. There's a lot of guys want to get rid of them because it takes up too much room, you know. And boy, this thing's really huge. You know, it is. It's a big box, but you can run any amplifier you want into it, and you're never going to have to worry about the thing arcing on you.
It looks like the Johnson has some big air variable caps in it, and a couple of coils, concentric coils.
Right, but the big deal is it's link coupled. There's no ballon inside there.
Ah, okay.
And I saw this demonstrated when I was younger. It kind of blew me away, and I was so young, I didn't really quite understand it. But this old fella took, and he had these NE2s, the little neon bulbs, attached to his antenna, or a antenna. I wasn't his main antenna because he'd have probably blown them out. But anyways, he showed me with the Johnson link-coupled box. I brought my antenna tuner over, and I tuned. And when I had a carrier going out, all the lights came on at the same time. And, you know, that's just the way it worked. Well, you put the Johnson matchbox on, and as you tuned it, the lights closest to the center would be on, and you'd keep tuning it until finally the inside lights went out and the outside lights toward the end of the antenna came on.
Oh.
So you had this control that for some reason wouldn't happen with a ballon. Now, I never understood that. It did never make any sense to me. Still don't understand it. But I do know there is a marked difference between a link-coupled Johnson matchbox and anything else out there. So, and I think, what do we have, David, here at the house now? Every time I see one for like $200, I buy it. What? How many we have? Four here now?
Probably closer to five or six.
Yeah, I mean, just in case one dies, we've got one. And they're really bad about the linkage. The linkage inside, they always come loose, you know. I keep one handy. I'll say, the linkage is loose. And rather than tear it down, I just grab the other one and then fix the other one when I get around to it. So anyways, but you'll get an antenna up. You'll have more fun than you can imagine. I love 75 meters at night. Now, some guys don't, but I really do. I like, you know, 40 meters is one of those bands. It's around the clock, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's a real good one for mobile operation. I really enjoy that. But I'm glad to hear you got the general, and I'm glad to hear you got a radio. And the only thing else you need to do is, well, when you get ready to put an antenna up, call us and we'll come over there and assist in putting up a real smoker.
We should have a party. We should have a barbecue. Get you, Holly, David, Matt, everybody to come on over, and we'll put us up an antenna.
Yeah,
I'll have it on hand. And actually, putting the antenna up will be less hard than making sure I've got the right coax or feed lines. But by the way, my office, which is also my ham shack, I've got a I'm in the basement, but the walls, both two walls of my office, actually face the outside. In other words, they're accessible from the outside. They're not earth covered at this point because I live on a steep hill. Right, so
that always helps when you have a window to go out of, you know, and you know, what is it? You got a window to go out of.
I have a window. We can also drill. We can bore through the basement walls. It's just concrete block, and we can go through and you'll put insulator in there, put some PVC, whatever we need to do to go through the wall.
He's getting overly
detailed here. He is. Yeah, I just
crack a window and put some feed through. Yeah. You know, feed line through it.
Yeah, that's what we do. I'm gonna jump around on you here, because now let me ask you this: did you ever have any interest in any of the ham radio or shortwave stuff when you were a kid? How did you get acclimated into radio? Period. And now we're gonna talk about broadcast radio, but how did you? What sort of evil possessed you, and how did it come about?
Well, just to wet your whistle, the first radio, quote, radio, unquote, of any kind that I was involved with was indeed shortwave listening. And I got to bring you to that point in the story, okay? So the reason I was, believe it or not, and I'm so glad you asked, and I hope you're ready for an answer that is a little bit intriguing. I think your listeners and you might actually find it a bit interesting. The reason I was interested in radio is because as a kid, as a 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old kid, I couldn't be involved in radio. And the reason I couldn't be involved in radio at all, it was totally impossible for me, was because I had a profound speech impediment. And so it was a dream beyond my dreams. I dreamed of being a disc jockey. I dreamed of talking to people on the radio or something, communicating by this wireless means. And I knew that I never would be able to do that because I stuttered profoundly. I don't mean a little bit. I mean almost every word was a chore for me to say, and it was a super chore for anybody to listen to. And I couldn't say my name. I couldn't say the street that I lived on. I couldn't read a book in class when all the other kids could. So the teacher always had me do sound effects. So I listened to AM radio first. That was the first thing. AM radio, my local station in little old Winfield, Kansas. I listened to KNIC, which I found out later that stood for Nice Radio for Nice People. So, and then I graduated to FM radio pretty quickly. Although in my very formative years, the station that sealed my interest in broadcast radio was KFH in Wichita, Kansas. At that time, it was on 1330 AM. I think they're somewhere else now. And I would listen to a weatherman, Cecil Carrier, in the morning. And I don't remember the main host. I just remember Cecil Carrier. It's such a great name. By the way, his daughter's doing TV weather in Wichita now. And I would listen to at night, I would listen to their half-hour news roundup on KFH, locally done. And then at 10:30 Central Time, when I was supposed to be asleep, on my 5-tube Sears radio, I would listen to the CBS Radio Mystery Theater. I'm telling you, I would just about pee my britches listening to that. On a starry night in Winfield, Kansas, you know, that was back when the UFOs and aliens were pretty big, when there was a lot of UFO sightings. So I'd be looking out. I had two big windows in my bedroom on the second floor of a creaky wooden house in Winfield, Kansas. And I would look out those windows and watch for aliens. Oh, man. And I think I'd hear noises at night. But, you know, the most common noise we heard at night there in Winfield was about a half mile away. And then more beyond that were those old oil wells that had the rocker arm, and they had a little engine that would go puck, 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 puck. And all night long you'd hear puck, 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 puck. So that you'd hear that noise, and you'd hear the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, and you just imagined that, you know, evil things were going to happen, alien things were going to happen. So that was what made me love radio. Now somehow I got hold of a Heathkit catalog, Now, you kind of have an idea where things will go from there, right?
Well, that's dangerous for any young person. You get a hold of a Heathkit catalog when they were young.
A 12-year-old with a Heathkit catalog? Are you kidding me? Actually, I was probably 11. And somehow I convinced my dad to get me this. I want to say it was a 4-band or it may have been a 6-band. It was their bottom-of-the-line desktop HF shortwave radio receiver. And I believe it was $60, but I could be wrong, and that was a fortune for my dad. So he bought it, and on teacher's salary, I put it together. At first, it didn't work. He took it over to a friend of his that had put Heathkit television together. They found a couple of cold solder joints that I had missed. Heated those up, and we tuned it right up, and it worked.
I'm just trying to think. I don't know the bottom. It seemed like, but could it have possibly been a GR64? Would it have a big, wide slide rule dial on it?
It did have a slide rule dial. Let me googly that real quick and see if that rings a bell. GR64 Heathkit and much. I don't know. That looks... Hang on a second. Let me get back to the...
Of course, you know, it's really weird because when you say bottom of the line and top of the line... You know, when you're young like that, you don't think that way. It's just you know, it's a cool radio. You know.
No, I tell you the one it was. It was not as impressive as the GR64. I've just found a picture of it. It was the Heathkit SW717.
I'll have to look that up. But the reason I say is I built a couple of GR64s.
Yeah.
You know, so they were. I loved Heathkits. What I ran into a situation where a lot of the fellas that were much older than I was would bring their kits over because they couldn't see real good, you know, and they'd want me to put the kit together for them, but I couldn't tell nobody, you know, because they had to be able to tell their friends, tell their friends they had built it, you know. But a lot of them would sit with me, which was kind of cool too, because I learned a lot from guys telling me, you know, correcting my soldering methods, you know, say no, you don't do that, you know. This is my kit. You can't do that. You don't fudge up my solder connections here.
Ted, I'm really so appreciative. Well, first of all, that you asked me to be on your show, but second of all, that you caused me to go back and think about this because I forgot what model this was, and I've looked it up, and my goodness, I'm looking at the circuit board. Wasn't that big or impressive? But I'm looking at the circuit board inside. That's it. I put this thing together.
Let me tell you what you're kit. now you're commissioned to a project, and let me tell you what that is.
Oh no!
This coming Dayton, you're going to have to come to Dayton and go out in the flea market and find that radio.
Okay.
I'm serious. That's what I was talking to Jim Teeterman, who's the vice chair of the Dayton Hamvention, and you know, in our conversation, we've come to the conclusion that the flea market at Dayton is where hams come to visit their old equipment. So that's what we do out there. You can ask David. I walked through the place. The mind blow was as I built an 811A amplifier. God, I don't know how old I was. I was probably maybe 19, something like that. And I mean, it was like ugly. I mean, it was one of the ugliest things that I had ever built, period. But it was from scratch. And, you know, so I don't know what happened to it. I mean, you lose these things. I mean, it's like you don't know. I can't tell you what happened. I had an Ico Tribander kit I built. I don't know what happened to it. I mean, it's obviously swapped it for something. But I'm going to the flea market, and all of a sudden they look down, and there's this ugly amplifier.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's got tubes in it and everything. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what do you want for this? You know, this guy told me, and I don't remember what it was. It wasn't a lot. Of course, it probably wasn't worth a lot, and I had David haul it off, but it's a perfectly good 811A amplifier. I mean, it works like a champ. I mean, I built it. But it's weird to build something in your teens and then be, you know, 60 years old and out of the Dayton Hamvention flea market and look over and here's this crazy thing that you built and it's sitting there only in ham radio. You know, I'm going to tell you another little radio story here just real quick. David can verify this because he was involved in it. There used to be. Now, how long have you lived in Nashville?
I've lived here since 2000, so right at 16 years.
I don't know. Maybe
he might have.
All right, there was a hardware store, and that was where was it on 21st? Where was it at 21st Avenue? Down there where the Belcourt Theater is, that strip down and through there. I don't know, but anyways, there was a hardware store, and somebody told me, and maybe it was Ronnie Millsap. I don't know. Said you need to go down there to that hardware store. So I went in. And I mean, there was every piece of radio gear. It was like walking into a ham fest or an antique, radio store or something, retail. Well, this guy had Hammerlin, Hallicrafters, all these names nationally, all this stuff in there. And there was all kinds of things you wouldn't even think of that you hadn't seen in years. And my dad had given me an old Gruno cathedral radio, shortwave and AM. And I had taken the knobs off of it, and I took it out of the case and sat it down on the chair next to my bed because I liked the tubes glowing in the dark. I took the metal shields off the tubes. I did everything you weren't supposed to do. And I could listen to hams on 40 meters on AM. Of course, the 40-meter band with 1/32nd of an inch wide on this thing, you know, so tuning was really critical. But I listened to it at night, listened to Radio Havana, Cuba, HCJB, Transworld Radio, all those shortwave stations. And once again, here's an old radio. I had wired up a connector to be able to record off of it. You know, so I went in like where the volume control was, and I think I went onto one side of the volume control through a couple of resistors and out with an audio cable. And then I had I disconnected the electromagnetic speaker on it and connected a little cable to it to run a permanent magnet. So I was bypassing all the extra wiring for the electromagnetic speaker. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but in some of them old radios, they actually used a voltage around a steel piece of steel to form an electromagnet to operate the speaker. And that's the way this thing was. But of course, once permanent magnet speakers came about, who in the world wanted to fool with that? So I got rid of that, had it all wired up like that. And then I was getting poked when I would stand on the floor and I touched the chassis. There was just enough voltage there to kind of give you, nail you a little bit. So I took the wooden knob that I had removed, and I put it on the volume control shaft so I could turn it on and off while standing on the floor. Now, I was in bed, it was all right, but on the floor, no, a little pokey, you know. So anyways, I put that knob on there, and I don't know what happened to the radio. It just vanished like everything else from your childhood, you know. Well, we're in this hardware store in Nashville, and I said to David, I said, on the bottom shelf, look down there and tell me what that says. And he looked, and he said, it says Grunau. I said, I know, I think it's pronounced Gruno. I said, bring it out here. Let me look at it. He pulls it out. There's a wooden knob stuck on the volume control shaft. And I start looking. There's the cable for recording, okay, and the little connector for the permanent magnet speaker. And I thought, what in the world? I mean, it's like, how in the world could this thing? I think it actually frightened me. Okay, I mean, I really think it scared me. So I asked the guy, what do you want for this? He said, oh, give me $55. And I looked at it and I thought, well, that's cheap enough. But, you know, and I don't know. In my head, I said, I don't want to carry any more junk home. I've got enough stuff, you know. And that's not me at all. Okay, I don't do that. You know, hams, first off, if you're a radio engineer and you're a ham, you never throw anything away, okay? Yeah, you never bypass any deal on a radio like that, you know? You don't eat
when you need it for parts.
Yeah, you don't eat for the next 2 weeks, but you got the radio, okay? Now, I left and got out of there, and then I was feeling kind of bad. I thought, you know, I should have bought that radio. My dad gave it to me. What's wrong with me? Why did I pass that up, you know? Well, I didn't give it any thought after that, other than I was just sorry as hell I hadn't done what I thought was the thing I should have done. But come Father's Day, there was this box wrapped up, and I looked. David had purchased that radio and snuck it out to the car and put it in the trunk and wrapped it up and gave it to me on Father's Day. So now, what do you think about that? You know, I mean, is that chance? Is it just circumstance or what? I mean, it's just weird, I think. It still creeps me out when I think about it. So, so anyways, when you're thinking about an old radio of some kind, it does. It brings back all kinds of memories. It brings back. Now, let me ask you this question. When you had that shortwave radio, what was the next step in your radio, experience? I mean, did you jump into broadcast radio and your shortwave listening and all that kind of stuff as a kid? Did it kind of fade out, or did it progress some?
Well, let's see. By the way, you mentioned HCJB was one of the first stations you heard, and that actually was the very first station I heard on that Heathkit SW717 was HCJB. And I thought, this is amazing. This is amazing. And then I found out that you could hear them anywhere on a, just about on a toothpick and a Dixie cup. But I was impressed. So, after that, well, it was about that time that I was overcoming my speech impediment. And actually, people say, how did you stop stuttering? Well, I stopped stuttering about the same time that girls quit having cooties, right? Because I knew this won't work. I want to talk to girls. I got to talk. So my next step, I took a little side trip into computers. We moved to a different house, and we weren't too far away from Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, Oklahoma. My dad was working on getting a doctorate degree there, and I found some kids to hang with who would go to the computer lab. And so we would go to the computer lab at night and weekends and times when we didn't think we'd be bothering anybody. And we would get on the terminals, and these were paper terminals. So we'd run through reams of paper playing that good old basic game, Wumpus. Remember that game, Wumpus?
I don't recall that.
Some people call it Catch the Wumpus or Find the Wumpus or whatever. But so I learned a little bit about basic programming because it seems like I didn't have an account. So I'm trying to think, maybe I had to type the program in every time before I could execute it. Because I don't think I had any storage on the computer. Anyway, so I took that little sideline into computers. And then we moved to Richmond, Kentucky. And my dad was teaching at Eastern Kentucky University. And I was a freshman in high school. And my dad said, hey, Kirk, the students at the university do something with media on Wednesday nights. If you want me to, I'll look into that for you. So he found out a little bit about it. In the meantime, I was going to be going to a high school that the university ran. And it turned out that the high school and the radio and TV stations for the university were in the same building, different entrances, but same physical building. So I started kind of looking around out there, hanging out. And so I got involved with the TV productions first, and they taught me how to run a big old RCA console, the blue and silver one with the round knobs. What's that classic console called?
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. And the knobs are, I should say, the meters are in the center. Generally, there was three, one for right channel, one for left, and one in the middle.
Yeah, this one had only, the TV one had 2 meters. I think the radio station one only had 2 meters. But so I learned about what a cart was, and we had actualities on carts. This was for TV now. Apparently with the students I was in high school, but the university students, nobody was interested in running audio because they all wanted to, you know, run cameras or the film chain or direct or be the floor director or something like that, or be the talent. Nobody really wanted to, you know, just run the audio board. So they let me do that. And I kind of learned how to run the audio board. Well, listen, check this out. So the radio station was right next door, and one door separated the radio and TV stations. So I'm just finishing up running the audio for their Wednesday night productions. And they had a little half hour newscast that they did. And then they had a 60 minute interview show called A Look At. And so I ran the audio for those two. Well, I was getting ready to go. And I guess I was going to call my mom or dad to come pick me up because I couldn't drive at that point. And this guy, this black dude with a big afro, opens the door from the radio station to the TV station, and he says, hey, he said, how'd you like to play some jazz for about an hour? I said, sure, what do I do? He said, I got the records all picked out right here. Come on over here. And he showed me the records. He said, this console, it's the same as what you got over there at TV station. I said, okay. And he said, just play the records, and here's the station ID. You play that. Man, I got to go. I'll be back in an hour. I don't know what he had to do. I'm sure it was a hot date in the girl's dorm or something. So I sat there and played records for an hour, jazz records. I don't think I said anything, but I got interested in being on the radio. And so I started looking into that. And some months later, they granted me the opportunity to be a news intern. And so my job was rewriting news stories. I would just take an AP or UPI. They had UPI. I was a UPI news story on paper, right? Printed out by that, that machine, the teletype. And I would just rewrite the same news story in different words. And my dad was an English teacher, so I had a pretty good handle on the English language, and it was actually pretty easy for me to just recast a story in different words. and they wanted to keep their newscasts fresh. So that's what we did, and that's what I did, and that's how I got started.
That's a good old console though to learn on. If I'm right, of course that had the big round knobs and the Daven wire wound pots on the inside.
They may have been wire wound, but they were those stepper pots, you know. I mean, from one click to the next was a good 3 dB.
Okay, well, then they were the original Daven pots, and weren't wire wound. Yeah. Well, the Daven pots with those steps, that was, I mean, if you learned on one of those boards, they had a certain feel to them, and you couldn't, that's not duplicated anywhere else. It really isn't.
Oh, no. It's not. The combination of the wipers, which had an angled cut to the finger, to the wiper that would wipe the little metal knobs around the ends, and then stretched between them were the resistors. I took one apart one time, not at this radio station, but later on, I took an old one apart, and that's why it's like that. And people would you'd open the back of the attenuator up. You say Daven, I always said Daven. I don't know which is right, but I remember they were on printed on them was Daven Step Attenuator. That's the name of them. It was a step attenuator because it worked in steps, like 3 dB steps.
And I don't know why I said wire wound. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know. The Daven pots have always been, they've always been stepper pots. But what's really funny about those things, and that is when audio processing started to get a little aggressive, you couldn't really fade a record completely with those things because the last step was still too loud, and it would feed enough into the processor to where it would suck up the sound. So you kind of had this, fade it. You're trying to fade, and then all of a sudden it just goes off, because the first division on the pot was too loud to fade.
You're right. So what we did, I mean, this was before I was an engineer, but I somehow I grasped these concepts really quickly. I don't know how, but the idea was to set the input level of each source to the console such that you had to run the pot not quite full open, but probably at the 3 o'clock position for the pointer. So it was almost all the way up. Doing that would give you the most amount of attenuation down at the low end before it hit zero. So you had the best chance of avoiding the problem you just described by having the input level of the source, whether it's a turntable, a microphone, cart machine, whatever, such that you had to have this knob almost all the way up, that would give you the best, low end performance at the bottom of its travel.
I was trying to think with the RCA boards. I'm trying to think of the switches on them. The switches were incredible. I mean, they were heavy duty. I don't know who built those. I used to know, but between the switches and the Daven step attenuators, those things were like magic. I know where I saw the first one, I think, that I saw that I worked with was a WQRS in Detroit, but it was a stereo version.
The FM one I used was a stereo version. Yeah.
And it was, I was really impressed. Although everybody tells me they were noisy. They're a real noisy console, but back then I didn't know that. I mean, I was sitting in a studio.
They may have been. I didn't know it either because this was a classical station. They played some jazz at night, but during the day it was classical, and they played. Of course they were playing records at the time. So the best you could do was whatever dynamic range was available on a record. What is that? About 45 dB, maybe 50 dB on a record album before you're down in the noise. So the limiting factor was probably the signal to noise ratio of the vinyl record itself, and then you had the noise from the preamps amplifiers in the RCA console. And then I remember our on-air audio processors at this station. Remember, it was a classical station. It had been built 15 years prior to me coming there with a one-time grant, right? Corporation for Public Broadcasting grant. And so the audio processing was two of those Marty, what were they, BL-10s or no, CL-10, the Marty CL-10, compressor limiter 10. And there were two of them. They weren't tied together, so left and right were totally independent of each other. for FM. And then it went into a Mosley stereo generator, the kind with a big mono stereo buttons on the front, because during newscasts, of course, we went to mono because the law said you had to be in mono if you weren't broadcasting stereo programming. And from there, from that noisemaker, the Mosley stereo generator, it went to a Mosley 505 STL transmitter, and then out to the transmitter site some miles away.
Well, now, did you ever see the exciters that were built? They said RCA on them, but they were built by Mosley, and they had a black face, and they had these little drawers that would pull out for the SCA, and I don't know, there was one, I guess, for the one for the stereo generator and one for the SCA. They put out about 15 watts. I don't know if you ever noticed those, but those were Mosley's, and they were around. Well, I bought one used back a few years ago, and gave it to Matthew for Christmas. Big mistake.
did he try it out?
Oh, not only did he try it out, but what did you guys tell Kirk what you guys built that you later wound up pulling way up at the top of a tree?
Matthew is really good at messing around with building antennas, and I was really good at climbing trees. So I was the honorary one that pulled everything into and pulling everything up into the trees.
But what was it that you guys built?
A three-bay antenna?
Yeah.
Holy cow. Most people don't go to trouble to build even one bay. They have enough trouble getting that to match.
Well, they had it, and they had it matched, and they had it up in the tree. I lived out on Hogan's Branch Road in Hendersonville, which is north of Hendersonville, outside of the city, but far enough north you're not quite to White House. All right, so I'm in Lebanon. And I get this phone call that says, hey, Dad, tune in whatever it was, 101 point whatever or 103 point whatever. So I punched it up on the car radio, and it was a station coming in pretty strong. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to get closer to the house before I'm going to be able to hear what they're doing. And so I kept driving and driving, and I got into Gallatin and went over the bridge and then got onto Gallatin Road and started driving, toward New Shackle Island. And it was still there. And then it finally hit me that I was picking up whatever heck it was they were transmitting. And they had it up. They had this three-bay up in a tree running it on this Mosley exciter or this RCA exciter. They had better coverage than some of the Nashville stations did. A 10-watt power level or whatever it was that the thing put out, So, when you were talking about the Mosley exciter, I thought, because they were the ones that built all those for RCA.
And I recall I never had to troubleshoot one of those. In fact, I may have taken a couple of them out of service, but I recall people telling me that the circuitry in there, that which was logic circuitry, for turning on off various things, was RTL, resistor transistor logic. This is before TTL logic.
Gee, I wouldn't know that. The looks of this thing, I wouldn't think there'd be anything that sophisticated in it,
Well, it did have a stereo mono switch, and I think that actually did some switching of, taking the left and right inputs and either keeping them separate or blending them together, or taking the left split to both, right split to both. I think it had those kind of functions.
Well, you're an audio processing guru. Well, it was CBS, I think it was. I believe it was CBS that made, was it Automax, Volumax, or something? And when you're talking about technology, one of those that had NuVistors in it. And you remember the NuVistor?
Yeah, I remember. I've never had to replace one, but I have seen them.
Mm-hmm. And I'm told now, of course, if you own one of those relics and you're actually using it, that if that NuVistor goes out, you're in trouble.
Yeah,
you're gonna be able to find one like it, but there's been some. I guess I want to say some quirks. When you were talking about processing on a classical station, this station I was talking about, WQRS in Detroit, that was also classical and folk and jazz. But they were, I remember that they were. I don't remember what they were using for processing, but it was very little and nothing because they really didn't like anything on there that would provide any form of gain reduction or expansion or anything like that. They wanted that out of the way. Have you ever worked at a station that had a level devil?
Oh my gosh, yes. A Shure level devil? No. Oh, the level devil, yes, but you made me think of something else. A mic processor called the Shure Level Lock. But yes, I remember the Level Devil. I believe we had one. I don't think it was in service anymore at an AM. I worked at one AM station, WEKY in Richmond, Kentucky. Actually, it was actually the second station I worked at. And they had some, the engineer there, a guy named Don Stocker, and he's a great guy. But in the early days, Don was a little bit crazy. You know, not unlike David and Matt, and maybe you. And Don had like four audio processors in series with each other before the audio got to the transmitter site. Or got to the transmitter. It was pretty brutal. It was amazingly loud.
Everybody on the air sounded like an asthmatic, right?
Oh, yes. And the first processor that your voice went through was the Shure Level Lock, which was in the kind of the classic little Shure case like the M57 mixer was in, but it didn't have any knobs on the front. It only had a slide switch. Now, and the slide switch had three positions, something like 6 inches, 12 inches, or 18 inches. That's what it said on the front. Make your own conclusions. But what it was a mic level in, and I think it was a mic level out. Maybe it's a line level out. But all I know is our mic, the main mic, plugged into there first, and this thing, something in it, some demon inside of this box would reach its hand, its demon hand, out of the front of the microphone, into your throat, down through your body. It would grab the part of your manlyhood that makes your voice deep, and it would grab it, and it would pull it back out, shove it through the phone lines, through the transmitter, and up to the light bulb at the top of the tower, and let it go.
I've never heard that before, but I've seen the Level Locks before, but I had no idea that they had that kind of capability.
If you had any, as they say in the business, if you had any balls at all, it would make the most of them, believe me. And it made everybody on our station sound like, I mean, just the voice of God resonating in your speakers.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah, we had there were those radio stations. So, you know, you were talking, though, earlier about stuttering. I was going to ask you, did you ever run across a fellow that worked at WCFL on the air? He went by Jim Bernard, real name Jim Hebel. And it was a very strange thing. Jim stuttered, I mean, bad, until he was behind a microphone. And once he was on the air, he was fine. Off the air, he stuttered. And it just always amazed me. I mean, we'd go out to dinner with him, and we'd say, okay, now here you go. Pretend this is a microphone. Talk into this, you know. But I wondered about that. You know, and that is a fascinating thing in itself, and that is how all of that works. Because you said just as soon as you were old enough to understand what girls were, you know, the stuttering just kind of like went out the window. One way or the other, you mastered it. And I found that strange. It was the same thing like the phenomenon with Mel Tillis. You know, he'd stutter like crazy, but get behind a microphone and sing, no stuttering at all.
Well, and back when I was a kid, they thought that stuttering was related to being ambidextrous. And I was ambidextrous. So you left-handed and right-handed. And so I actually did physical therapy to cause me to be one or the other. We chose left-handed because I seemed to favor that a little bit more. So I became left-handed, but that didn't stop the stuttering. Their theory, and in fact, if you tell a speech therapist nowadays about, you know, what the therapy they put me through, literally, the speech therapist will laugh in your face because that's the craziest thing, and which doesn't feel very nice that you know, you then realize that, okay, you think I spent all that time wasting that time. But you know, in the end, somehow I stopped stuttering. And I think it did have something to do with the therapy, but it also had to do just with, I think pretending I was on the radio really helped, because if you're on the radio, like you can't stutter. That would be no good. So you've got to just persevere and push on. And you even in your mind's eye or in your mind's ear, you hear yourself talking without stuttering. To me, that was the best therapy, is imagining that I could talk without stuttering. So I don't know. I think that has a lot to do with it. Boy, there was something else I was going to say about that. Now it has slipped my mind.
That's something that happens on this radio show something will pop into your head, and you'll kind of interrupt yourself, and then you forgot what you were going to say. I do it all the time. It's like, now, you know, okay, but now you work right now in the broadcast industry, and you're working for a company that I think is, you know, totally cutting edge. I mean, my experience with Telos, Omnia, Axia has been, I guess I want to say it's been a very unusual thing. My first encounter with anything was I was working for Cashbox Magazine when I met Frank Foti, the guy that, I guess it was he the proprietor, does he own the company, or I don't know how that works.
I don't think he was a 50% partner at first, but he now is the majority shareholder in the company. So he's the CEO and calls himself Il Padrino.
I don't know what that means, but anyhow,
it's the godfather of the company.
All right. Yeah. Well, anyways, well, you know what? He would wear that title well, I think.
He does.
Anyhow, I was working at Cashbox, and I was trying to get the radio side of the magazine tuned up. So I was looking for people who could add something, you know, to it. So here was this budding new audio processor guy that was, you know, obviously going up against Bob Orban and I don't know who else at the time. But I contacted him and I said, hey, why don't you write, because this magazine went to every radio station in the country. I said, why don't write an article about audio processing, and why don't you talk about your Unity 2000 at that time? That's what he had. And, you know, and so he wrote like a whole series of articles in Cashbox. And I'll tell you, the radio programming people just went absolutely crazy over it. They thought that was the coolest thing. Well, then, I don't know. He told me it really gained him an awful lot of attention and a lot of business, because there were people in radio reading this stuff, and there'd never been an article on audio processing in a publication or a trade magazine. You know, and back then, Cashbox was on equal ground with Billboard, actually a little bit more prominent, because Dick Clark used Cashbox magazine on American Bandstand, and the owner of Cashbox, which was George Albert, got Dick Clark his first DJ job in Philadelphia. So it's a lot of ties there. And old George Albert, the guy that owned the magazine, he was well connected somewhere. He lived next door to Bob Hope and also to Frank Sinatra, out there in Palm Springs. He was very well connected with whatever you get connected with when you're in the coin operated and jukebox business and records and charts and all that sort of thing. But my position there was to put all of it on the internet, and that's what I was doing. And so Frank wrote all these articles, and it went over just incredible. I mean, it really did. The program directors just ate it up. Well, anyhow, to make a long story short, later I'm on my way, and I'm going through New York City.
Yeah.
And I got the radio on, and you know, and I'm working at a couple of stations, and we got Optimod 8100s with the XT chassis and all that. And you know, if you wanted to add, you know, a composite clipper, and you know, some of these guys are putting prisms on them and all this. And I'm riding through New York City, and all of a sudden I'm hearing these stations. I heard two on the dial that were just like, where, how are they getting these high frequencies on the air? Because I always thought FM, you know, I never heard sparkly sounding high frequencies, never.
Right.
Not to my liking, you know.
And maybe you've explained this before, but to let your listeners know, you know, because of the FM preemphasis curve, where in transmission the high end is boosted dramatically, and then it's cut down by an equal amount in your receiver, it's actually pretty hard to push lots of sparkly high frequencies through an FM transmitter and have it all be legal and loud. And the way that Orban did it was pretty traditional. He had a few good ideas, but still it had this densed up sound where the, as Frank Foti would say, the high end sounded constipated. And Frank developed a mean of flipping the order of the functions around. He had a little more work to do to make that work out right, but the net result was he got a sparkly sound through the air, through the FM system, and keeping it all legal and legal modulation. So that was pretty extraordinary.
Well, I called the two stations on the phone. I said, what is this? I got a hold of the engineer, and he says, oh, we've got this box in here, and it's called an Omnia Hot. And I said, an Omnia Hot? I thought, what in the world is that? You know? So I called the other station, and I got on the phone with them, and they had an Omnia something, but it wasn't an Omnia Hot. Okay, so, but they were both Omnia processors. So I said, well, who makes this Omnia? Then when I found out, Frank Foti. I had, you know, of course, I had lost touch with him or anything like that, but they stood out on the dial so dramatically. It was like, you know, unbelievable. So I got a hold of him, and of course, I don't know, but at that time, I can't remember what Omnia they were on, but I know we wound up at one radio station with a couple of the Omnia 6s, and they did have that ability. They just sounded brighter, cleaner, and more musical on the air than the counterparts. And it was interesting because a lot of people that, like, people say they sound too much like a CD. And I was thinking, well, isn't that what you want? Don't you want it to sound like a CD? You know, no, they want compression. And I've noticed that with guys in radio, if it doesn't have enough, if it's not compressed enough and squashed enough in their headphones, it's like they're off key. They're off in another territory somewhere. They can't get their feet on the ground. You know,
it's too clean. I had the same experience. Actually, it was in Minneapolis at a country station. I put an Omnia processor there to demo it to them, and everybody liked it. But the program director said, "There's kind of a problem here. It doesn't sound like radio." I said, "Yeah, no, it sounds like the CD." He said, "Yeah, but it doesn't sound like radio. Can you make it sound more like we used to?" I said, "You mean you want to make it sound more like the previous processor, the Orban?" He said, "Yeah, I want that high end to sound." I said, "Muddy?" Yeah, muddy. So, I kept telling Frank, the one thing we need to sell more Omnia processors is to have a preset in the processor called the 8400 preset and make the high end just sound constipated, and voila. That way they can move into the Omnia, and then when they're ready for a cleaner sound, they can go to another preset.
You know, in the amateur radio ranks, you know, audio now has become a lot more critical than it was years ago. I mean, you've got guys on AM building PDM transmitters that they're running on ham radio, and even on sideband, you've got guys putting in wide filters, and they're using, you know, Heil PR40 microphones and using EQ. And some processing on, and I was thinking, now you really ought to build a ham radio audio processor, you know, like something stripped down, like a, you know, like an Omnia One, but give them, you know, just EQ control and a little, you know, a little compression and whatnot, so that they can get on and fiddle with it. Because these guys, I'm telling you, you know, when you go to the Dayton Hamvention, they've got this area in there where Bob Heil is, and they call it Audio Alley. And there's guys in there building. They've got audio processors for sale, equalizers. You were going to say something, David.
I mean, everybody, you know, microphones and all that kind of stuff. I mean, anything to squeak out, you know, that distant contact.
Yeah, you know, I remember we used to take a D104, which has got a massive crystal element inside of it, and you'd plug that into something like a Waters compreamp or a clip reamp or a Vibratrol compressor, Demco power modulator compressor, plug that into your rig, and you get on the air, and you were loud and you were clipped and you almost sounded a little tinny. Chip Margelli said, it sounded like your shorts are too tight. That's how we describe it. You know? But for working DX, that's, you know, for you know, it gives you the maximum amount of articulation and all that. And I thought, you know, y'all ought to delve into that. I wouldn't think it'd be that hard to do. You know,
of course, the easy way to do that is would amateur radio operators, would they go for a PC based or a Raspberry Pi based audio processor, or does it need to be in a big iron box?
Oh no! The Raspberry Pi would be fine. It would be, that would work out real well, because a lot of a lot of guys are into Raspberry Pi. They're building all sorts of things out of them. So no, that would be one way to go. But that would be
All right. So we got to come up with a good mic pre, and then the proper output on the Raspberry Pi. So we got to come up with a circuit board that's got a good mic pre that'll handle different kinds of mics that ham radio operators use.
Well, you know, Bob Heil is a big advocate of purchasing like a small Mackie or Behringer board and connecting it to the output of your radio, and so that you have EQ there, you know, and you can vary it. And then I think some EQ on the mic side too, you know. So it's kind of but there's a certain sound I think that they're wanting for DX operations. And I saw Chip Margelli was showing this. I don't know if you've ever heard this done, but I'm on a PR40 right now, okay? But if I take my hands and cup it around the screens, then the microphone sounds like this.
Yes,
it does. I don't know if you've ever done that before.
Oh, I do it all the time. It's just so I can sound like you.
You cup your hands over the PR40 and talk into the microphone like this. I thought it was amazing the first day. You realize how much that baffling is really doing in there.
It is doing. I'm not using the PR40 at this moment. I should have. I mean, I happen to still have my Sennheiser MKH416, which is that shotgun mic. That's what I'm talking on now. The PR40 is over in my server room. I should have grabbed it before the show. But you're right. It has Bob Heil talked me through a little bit of how the PR40 works. And man, there's a lot of mechanical acoustics in that microphone just by the very design of the baffles and where stuff is. It's truly amazing.
Well, it's great in a radio station because if you're off axis, you aren't there.
Yeah.
And in a talk studio, it's wonderful.
Yep.
Because the person sitting next to you is not feeding into your microphone and you're not feeding into theirs. And that makes for really good, a very good talk environment where, you know, so many of these mics are so omnidirectional. I mean, they're supposedly unidirectional, but not like the PR40. You take the PR40 and turn it sideways here. I'll show you where I turn it. That's just really weird. I just dropped right completely off.
I know. It's crazy. I've demoed that to people too. It's really great.
So, but anyways, we were talking about Frank Foti. We were talking about Telos Alliance. And now I don't know of anything that you guys are not into. When I first met Kirk, it was over the Omnia processors. I believe we talked about those and you came out and adjusted at a couple of stations and whatnot. And you got into the Telos phone systems, and I don't know what all you I don't know what you're doing now. I know is this guy, he flies all over the world.
Yeah, he's like the ambassador to the world.
Yeah, and so I don't know if there's any drugs involved or what's going on here. You know, you heard him say Foti considers himself the Godfather. Yeah, you know, so tell folks a little bit about what mm-hmm. what do you think about the fact that your early love for, you know, getting started with listening to shortwave radio and all that, do you not think that kind of led you down the path you needed to go in order to get where you are now?
Yes, I had on the tip of my tongue, I can't remember, but it's a long and shallow money trough filled with pimps and thieves and signifying nothing. But watch out because there's a dark side too. So when I first started working for Telos, I met a guy who's still my boss to this day, Marty Sachs, and Marty and others there hired me to basically be the Omnia demo boy. You know, I would go on the road and I'd have an Omnia under my arm and I'd go to radio stations and see if they let me put it on the air to see if they would sound better. And it got to the point where some stations were like, nah, we don't really want to go off the air to try anything new. So what I would do is I brought an Omnia and whatever the latest Orband was under the other arm. I actually had both processors with me. I say, fine, let's go in your production room and A-B these two. And so in some cases, that's what we would do. And we had a few shootouts. We even had one shootout in San Francisco in Bob Orban's backyard. And Frank Foti showed up and Bob Orban showed up and they were switching back and forth and there was a little grumbling on both sides about the tactics being used. I'm actually not sure who won out in the end. I know that there was a strong bias in the air toward toward the other guys. So we were the underdogs. But I did that for a couple of years. And then at the Telos Alliance, one of the things I love about this company is that, you know, it's kind of like working at a restaurant. You're probably not going to be doing the same thing, 2 months from now. You may move from being busboy to waiter to host to valet guy to taking out the garbage to maybe cooking the eggs. And so I've had like 8 different titles at the Telos Alliance, what's now called the Telos Alliance. And as soon as they find something I'm good at, maybe they'll stick me in. Let me keep the same job for a while. But I've had like 8 different jobs there. And one of the things I love about working with these guys, Frank Foti and his team, of course, Steve Church founded the company. Steve passed away about 3.5-4 years ago. And so things have changed a bit since then. And a lot of good things have remained the same, though. The company has also been more and more diversified. So a few years ago, we bought a company called Linear Acoustic. They're famous for making audio processors for television. So they do a lot of surround sound. That means they do a lot of upmixing, and they also do a lot of audio control in the surround area. So that means that if you've got like a football game and you've got crowd mics in the surround speakers, they need to find a way to control that so the crowd doesn't pump up and down in volume, you know, so things stay natural. Hey, for all of the listeners here, if you watched any of the Olympic games, like for the last 3 Olympics, on NBC, most of that audio was controlled and put into surround by Linear Acoustic boxes. In fact, we sent one of our guys down to Rio for 6 weeks in this last Olympics to make sure everything ran right. And then we also acquired a company called 25/7. That's a weird name, right? 25/7. Their original box, their original idea was a box that would, we'll delve into some inside baseball here. If you run syndicated talk shows on the radio, you probably know that if you run the Rush Limbaugh show, it's different than all the other talk shows. It's different in that Rush takes more of your advertising time for himself, and you get less advertising time for the radio station. So the guys at 25/7 came up with a box that basically sped up the Rush Limbaugh show, giving you 2 more minutes of commercials to run locally because you weren't getting those with Rush as compared to the other talk shows. So this box actually added an extra 2 minutes to every hour. And it was smart enough to actually keep Rush's commercials the right length. So his advertisers weren't getting shafted 2 seconds. But Rush was getting sped up. So that company, one of the cool pieces of tech in that company, and this is kind of interesting from an audio perspective, 25/7 has this algorithm for doing what we think of as being, you know, the Eventide product that does profanity delay, right? So you start out a talk show and everything's fine and you're in real time, but this box speeds stuff up until you have a 7-second delay going on and you don't hear it work. Well, actually the one from 25/7, you really don't hear it work. That way you can dump out if you have to, if somebody says a dirty word. Well, and then it builds back up again, builds the time back up again. And at the end of a show, if nobody has said a dirty word, you hit the ramp down button and over a couple of minutes, it ramps back out to real time. Hopefully nobody will say a dirty word in the last 2 minutes. There's a hint for you, by the way. If you want to call a talk show and say a dirty word, be on for the last 30 seconds of the show. You'll probably get it in.
Get your dirty word on the air.
That's right. So we bought that company, and these are the guys, and I know there's a lot of mixed feeling about this, but these are the guys who also have the Voltaire technology for the audio watermarking, shall we say. We won't use any brand names. At least it gives you some control over that.
The Nielsen tones that sound so horrible on the radio? Is that what you're talking about?
That's what you're talking about. Exactly. That's exactly right.
Well, what folks don't understand is what they've done in a lot of markets is they have put out these little pagers. They look like pagers. They're little black things that you clip on your belt. They're supposed to pick up the radio station that you're listening to And the station that you're listening to is encoding tones with their data on it that will cause the pager to register as having been listened to. And what those things do is they make these encoders, the Nielsen company does, and it's supposed to hide the tones behind audio.
Yeah.
But what they did is they picked 1 to 3 kilohertz, which is right in the middle of the Fletcher-Munson curve, the most sensitive part of the human ear. And then they pick those tones that are not exactly what I would consider to be sine waves. So they combine and they do all kind of strange things, and they become very audible to the ear in a lot of cases. Probably a Reba McEntire song really shows off the Nielsen tones. This has been a very controversial thing, and of course, yeah, I've gotten into it way over up my ankles and up to my knees. And I don't understand why it is why we can't take a radio station and encode it, okay, just like they encode, or you know, whatever, have a box sitting there that's listening to that radio station, and it's a choice that can be made by a piece of software like Shazam. Yeah, so as you're listening, you know, the thing says, whoops, that's WXYZ, you know, because it's encoded 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with all the rest of the stations in town. And when your device picks it up off your cell phone, it automatically knows, because of the encoding, what station that you're listening to. I don't know why they got to dump these tones right in the middle of it's a sonic horror show. And
sonic horror show.
It is an absolute sonic horror show.
But by the way, the technology that you've describing as an alternative, using the same fingerprinting technology that Shazam uses, we talked about that in SBE meeting. And I went home and came up with a whole business model and technical model for how that would work. And then only after I put, you know, basically 6 hours worth of writing into this, because it was a great brainstorm, I decided to look up patents on Google, and what I found out is that entire idea that you've just been discussing and that we talked about at SBE, that's already been patented by Nielsen.
Yeah, well, I don't know. To me, here's how it works. To me, they are the New York syndicate. They sell protection to radio stations. You know, you pay them $20,000 a month, and they will make sure that you get registered in the book, okay? And if you don't, you're going to get a dead fish under your door. You don't want that, you know?
And if Ted doesn't show up for next week's show, you'll know what happened to him.
I think it's criminal myself. I think what they're doing to the radio industry is just sacrilege. You know, I think that, you know, we need to have high fidelity on the air. People spend thousands of dollars for audio processing equipment to make their stations sparkle and sound good. And then here we come and we dunk garbage, you know, on the air, you know, right. It's like as if you came into your living room, you know, and Nielsen says, well, look, we want to do ratings here. So here we're bringing a bucket of dead fish and cow manure, and we're putting it right in your living room where you're watching television or listening to radio. It's just not right. And I know you, in your position, you can't really say what I'm saying, but I can say it because it's true. And I wouldn't say it if it wasn't true. But I'm not the least bit impressed by that system. I think that with the technology that's available, plus it's an old system. My God, how long has this been around? You know, I mean, they need to update. They need to upgrade. This is ridiculous for it to go on like that. But the company, 25/7, had built a box that you can put on the radio station, and it makes sure that those tones stay at the proper level, and you can monitor them so that they don't get obnoxious on the air, and you can still have in confidence knowing that those tones are going out in a way that you're going to be counted. And if they're not counted, they don't show up in ratings. If they don't show up in ratings, they don't have revenue. So, I mean, it's just that simple. It's a catch-22 thing. But that's one of the most ingenious pieces of equipment that I have seen. Jeff Stedman, I think, is a genius anyways. I think he's the creator of it, as far as I know.
Jeff is, and also we have an MIT PhD on our staff, and that's Dr. Barry Blesser. And he's the R&D behind it, although Jeff is a large amount of it, too. Jeff's kind of like the guy that makes it happen, and Dr. Blesser is the guy that theorizes about it.
Well, so, let's go this far. I've had people ask me. They say, "Hey, Ted, what are you running on the air? What are we running here in the studio?" And we're running a Heil PR40 microphone. We have an Axia Radius console, and all this audio that goes out to WTWW is fed basically through this Axia system, which is, you may want to explain just briefly what this is. But we have, I remember Matt came in here the first time at Christmas time. I opened up a gift, and it was a node. And I said, well, what am I going to do with this?
What am I going to do with a node?
Yeah, what is this, man? I mean, you know, I said, give me my Autogram analog console. This is all BS, and I don't want to have any part of it, you know. Okay, so we got that, and the next thing I know, he purchased two of the drivers to go on a couple of the computers
right,
in here.
Yeah.
You know, so, and they're expensive, but nonetheless, I mean, I kept saying, well, he said, well, we're going to pull the sound cards out. Well, how are we going to run it? He said, well, you don't need it with these. So he puts these drivers in, okay? So the drivers are in all the computers in here. We are actually a broke at this place, I'll tell you what. Yeah. But let me tell you, and you're not, and Frank is not too far off, because once you get this in a broadcast environment, it's like heroin, you know? You can't go back to analog. I mean, no, I'm sitting here thinking, wait a minute, I got to put this on, I got to go to machine number two and record on it. So, you just jump in and you pick the source, boom, it's there, and you forget about it. You know, it's so quick. We're across town, and I log into this thing, and I'm switching stuff over. I'm doing, we move everything around. We got three transmitters on the air. We feed all three of them, off of this Radius console. And you can control it. You can control the console by remote. You can get control. And then Matt built up this thing. Although I will say this piece is how would you say it? It's pirated, probably. I don't know. He had a motherboard from someplace that's the exact match. Put the soft surface software on it, and loaded it, and it's like fantastic. I mean, I would tell anybody, if you can't afford nothing else, buy the soft surface. Because you can do anything with it. You know, I prefer it because we're out so much. When you log in, it's so simple to load sources and to move things around and feed one transmitter, one thing, something else, all off this soft surface. Fantastic stuff. So, I mean, you are really fortunate, Kirk, because you're working for a company that's right on the very top of the cutting edge. And I can't think of any other broadcast gear that even compares to it. I mean, I really can't. There's nothing out there. I mean, there's other digital consoles and stuff, but it can't do what this stuff does.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The other thing about this stuff is it's the simplicity. You know, I really believe you could train, if you had enough bananas, you could train a monkey to run a Radius. You know, I really do. I believe that. I really do. And that's really important, because when a person, even with personalities and people on the air, the equipment really is supposed to disappear. I go back to the days of Bill Drake. He always insisted on a board operator and an announcer in the announce booth. And the reason why is he didn't want the guy on the air to be encumbered with the mechanics of the broadcasting business.
Yeah.
He wanted the guy to be talent. And the guy said, so one thing I think that this whole system does, and of course there's the Telos phone stuff, which is incredible. And what are you guys on now? I mean, We're running a VX22 here, but you guys are now on to something else. What is it called, the new one?
The one
we can't afford. What is it called?
Well, there is the VX, which is a SIP VoIP system.
Uh-huh.
I'm
that again, and I'm cutting you right off, man.
So this is worthwhile for anybody to know. I'm sure plenty of amateur radio operators, plenty of hams have gotten rid of an analog phone line, and they're bringing a digital service in, a digital phone service in, because it takes the phone companies, gosh, decades to get anything right or to get it together. But someday, all of our phone calls will be high fidelity. Now you get some of that going on now, but of course, everybody's heard of VoIP or voice over IP, and a lot of times we use the word SIP, which is session initiation protocol. That's just the most popular protocol in which VoIP is implemented, right? So there's different ways to do VoIP. There have been some older standards years ago, but now everybody's pretty much doing SIP, session initiation protocol. And when, so if like here at my office, I've got an office phone made by a Chinese company called Yealink, and it just connects to my internet, and it actually does its own VPN back to the Telos office in Cleveland, Ohio. And I have an extension from Cleveland right here in Nashville, and it just sounds perfect. And every call we make internal to the company, so if both parties are on the same asterisk phone system that we have there, you always hear it in 7 kilohertz of audio instead of 3 kilohertz of audio. So while they call that HD voice, I'm not, you know, most broadcasters would not say 7 kilohertz is high fidelity or high definition, but that's what the telephone industry says. Well, it does sound pretty good, though.
It is certainly better than the standard 3 kilohertz phone line.
It certainly is. And, you know, other companies have done this, too. I've got a Samsung phone. It's a Note 4. It does not explode. My wife has an iPhone 5. Maybe it's a 6. I forget. Whatever she's got. Anyway, we're both on T-Mobile. And whenever she calls me or I call her, we're talking using a codec that's called AMR wideband. So that gives you 7 kilohertz of audio, but it does so at a variable low bit rate. Like the highest it goes is 23 kilobits per second. So from a data carrying point of view, it's low overhead. It's 23 kilobits per second. It'll slide down to like something like 7 kilobits per second and, you know, give you 7 kilohertz of audio. So, man, she calls me, I call her. She's driving down the road. I swear, honey, are you in the office? No, I'm driving down the road, 70 miles an hour. Okay.
Hold that thought just for a moment, because I've got to take one quick break here. And I've got to tell folks about something. If you're listening to shortwave radio right now at home or wherever you're at on a portable or something, you really enjoy listening to shortwave, you prefer it to AM and FM, you wish you had it in the car. Well, let me tell you, at this point, it's easy done. It's called Car Shortwave Radio, and it's carshortwaveradio.com for their website. This thing is about the size of a paperback book. It goes in your glove box or under the seat or in the trunk or wherever you want to put it. No holes to drill, no wires and cables to get tangled. It comes through the FM section of your car radio, and the RDS reads out the frequency that Car Shortwave Radio is tuned to, and it's really sensitive. You see not just the frequency you're on, but you also have a readout for signal strength. And also, you have a readout for all the other functions. Now, you control this whole thing with a key fob, just like what you unlock your car with. It's a key fob. You hold it in your hand. It completely and totally controls the radio. There's a little antenna that clips either on your trunk or on the hood. Two little Allen screws hold it in place. And it's about a foot and a half long, so you don't have a real problem with car washes and drive-through windows and stuff. But the audio coming off of this thing, of course, it's better than standard AM broadcast. When you listen to Car Shortwave Radio and you're listening to WTWW, it makes your car radio sound like a Seberg jukebox. And once you have it, you'll realize that you couldn't live without it from that point on. Go to their website, check it out, carshortwaveradio.com. That's carshortwaveradio.com. Okay, now that we've done that, I want to ask you this question, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is, I want to turn this into a commercial, but how do you like T-Mobile?
Well, it's all a matter of expectations, isn't it?
Well, the reason why I say is I have never been so disgusted in my life as I have been with Verizon. I could tell you my phone stories, and I'm telling you, you get a box of Kleenex and you start crying because, I mean, it's unreal. And they seem to be, when you get on the phone and you say, look, I got this phone, it's got a 2-hour battery. 2 hours, it's gone. It's a brand new phone. This is what you gave me. It doesn't work. And it's like, they don't care. You know, and you got to really raise a stink. Now, I understand everybody says Verizon has the best network, but I'm not so sure that's true. I think since they've upgraded to their 4G or whatever, I think they've maybe overtaxed their system. I don't think it works as good as it used to. But I've thought about it. We were at Dayton, and we were on the air, and we couldn't get on the air because all of our Verizon wireless things didn't work. They all were all dead as doornails. And this guy comes by with a little T-Mobile cell phone.
Yeah.
He's somewhere from out of New York, and he's a technical guy. He brings it over, sets it on the table. He said, here, I'm going to set this up as a hotspot. Yep. And I logged into it. We had beautiful bandwidth. We did the entire broadcast, and we mailed his phone back to him later afterwards. What a good guy, you know. And I was so impressed by that. So I was wondering, how do you like you say expectations? So tell me what the downside is.
Well, the downside of T-Mobile is it works great in cities and along interstate highways. If your expectation is for it to work somewhere else, then you're going to be disappointed. So certainly Verizon and AT&T tend to have coverage even in areas of low population density. Now, the coverage may not be fast data, but typically you can talk. Well, with T-Mobile, if you get out in the hinterland, it's probably not going to work. Now, my direct experience has been that T-Mobile has increased their coverage area dramatically in the last 5 years or so. Just in the last 2 years, I'm part owner of some radio stations in Mississippi, down near Greenville, Mississippi.
See, he won't tell us about those radio stations. I've been trying to get him. Go ahead.
So, Highway 61 goes from Memphis down, past Tunica, Clarksdale, Cleveland, Mississippi, and to Greenville, Mississippi. And for years, you pass Tunica, and it only worked at Tunica because of the casinos there. For years, you'd pass Tunica, and you were out. You were radio silence for the next 2 hours until you got to Greenville and maybe had a little bit of signal coming across from Arkansas. They seem to have coverage in Arkansas, but not down. In the last 2 years, I don't know when it was. Now I get 4G data anywhere from 5 to 20 megabits per second all the way down there. So from my house in Nashville, I can take I-40 to Memphis, go south on U.S. Highway 61 all the way to Greenville, and there might be a quarter mile in a couple of places where I don't have good coverage. But I know you're not supposed to drive and watch videos at the same time, but I have had some music videos on almost the whole way. So at least there, the coverage is getting better. Now, a coverage story. I do a podcast called This Week in Radio.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that either. So it was, well, I don't think.
we'll do a little bit. It's your show. So we're not going to take a view.
Every week, Kirk puts out a podcast that relates to broadcasting. But, of course, we know that everybody that is in ham radio is relating to broadcast radio in so many different ways. And we all grew up with AM radios under our pillows and all that kind of stuff. So the broadcasting industry is a real close cousin to ham radio in so many ways. Matter of fact, with the Society of Broadcast Engineers, if you get the which one is it? The one certification they give it to you if you get the extra class ham license. I can't remember which certification it is. So, and most of the radio engineers that I know are also amateur radio operators. So, but anyhow. Yeah. Anyhow, now, the other thing is we're running out of time.
So shoot.
You're going to have to come back, and the reason why you're going to have to come back is I want to talk about your podcast, and I also want to talk about a few other things we didn't even get a chance to touch on. But talk about the podcast real quick, though, because as we're running out of time, I'd like folks to be able to find it and watch it, because I think they would really enjoy it.
So just to finish up the T-Mobile thing, so Chris Tobin and I do our podcast sometimes from on the road. Sometimes we're at the NAB show or other places. We're out of our usual offices, so we're having to use mobile data. And oftentimes we have used Verizon data, and it's been fine. In some places, it's been great. But in a few places, it's been non-existent, like at a hotel in Las Vegas in the courtyard where the signal was strong, but there's something wrong with the network management. So we tried the hotel's Wi-Fi. That was terrible. We tried the Verizon 4G LTE. It was terrible. By the way, we tried my USB stick and Chris's USB stick. So then we resorted to making my T-Mobile phone into a hotspot. Ta-da! 20 megabits up and about 10 megabits. 20 down, 10 up. Had a Skype in HD video, no problem. Now, my point there is not that T-Mobile's great, Verizon's terrible. My point is that you never know what you're going to get. So if you are trying to do mobile data out and about, if you've got a broadcast to do, a Skype video, something like that, where you need some data, you got to have plan A and plan B and probably plan C. And TV stations know this. You know, I've noticed Fox 17 here in Nashville, they run remote cars all around Nashville during their five hour morning show, and they're not using microwave truck.
Okay, we are out of time, so you got to talk about
the podcast.
Yes.
So with This Week in Radio Tech, it is on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Eastern time, Eastern local time, and it is on the GFQ network. You can find out about the podcast at my website, thisweekinradiotech.com, thisweekinradiotech.com, or you can see it at gfqnetwork.com.
And I know if you are a licensed ham, or even if you're just a shortwave enthusiast, not that that's any less significant, but you're going to enjoy Kirk's podcast every week. It's something different and intriguing. We're out of time. I want to say thank you for coming on board. This has been fun, and I think everyone listening would agree we need to do this again, because we this is not enough time. See, 2-hour radio show, not enough time. So anyways, thank you so much, Kirk. I appreciate your presence here.
All right, Ted, thank you all the listeners too, appreciate you.